I'm so glad to be joined today by both Dr. Zai and Dr. C. Dr. C, how the hell have you been?
I've been all right, man. Well, just in the manic prodrome.
Oh, you're prodromal. That's hypomania is
apparently calm before the storm. Oh, hypomania feels great, man.
Yeah, are you hypersexual?
Definitely.
Ugh.
But of the solitary kind.
Hypersexual.
That's actually the hypersexual incels are actually playing at Gabby's tonight. Okay. So today, speaking of bipolar like illnesses, why don't we go ahead and discuss psychotic illness with a focus on bipolar disorder, and divide that into the two, several important subtypes. Does that sound reasonable, guys? Is that something you might want to explore today, even in the hypomanic state?
Hell yeah. I mean, it's going to be sure. Testing for sure, like asking what the difference between the manic and the hypomanic is and all that nonsense.
Yeah, this is high yield. Absolutely. So, what's your understanding, Dr. C, of bipolar disorder?
Well, it's characterized by highs and lows. Bipolar 1 is the full manic, and that affects 1% of the population. Bipolar 2 is the hypomanic, and that probably could be a lot more. We don't really know.
Fair enough. Yeah, maybe we don't know because they're not presenting to the emerge with, the underwear on their head, screaming about Jesus. Now that's a little insensitive. You know, admittedly, there's a lot of people whose lives have been negatively impacted by bipolar illness, but we have to treat these things with a little bit of levity. Otherwise, we might go psychotic ourselves. To add to that definition, starting with bipolar 1, there has to be at least one manic or a mixed episode, that is a depressive episode not attributable to major depressive disorder. And the manic episode has to, and I think this is important, last at least 1 week with symptoms most of the days, with symptoms most of that week. So it's not this is not a several hour, I was irrationally spending, I have a mental disorder, please forgive me, type of thing. And Dr. I, you might agree, you can't miss bipolar. You can't miss mania. It's a very recognizable entity. Is that fair to say?
Oh, sure thing. You know, a lot of people listening to this podcast, I assume, will be rotating through the emergency psychiatry department, and I'm sure you'll see at least a couple cases, or even just an emerge. You know, one of the main things that kind of separates the manic patient out from some of the other differential diagnoses that you want to be considering, you know, substance-induced psychosis and BPD should be on your radar, and schizophrenia as well. One of the main things to kind of consider with that acute presentation is some of the grandiosity associated with a manic episode, as opposed to in schizophrenia, where you would get more of a kind of paranoid psychosis picture. And we'll dive into that a little bit more, into what the specific traits of a manic episode are. But just to kind of set the picture, you're really focusing on somebody who is elevated and has high self-esteem quite a bit of euphoria potentially, or restlessness and agitation and aggression, but all mostly stemming from a grandiose delusion rather than something where they're fearful and hypervigilant.
Right. And I think that distinction is really important because schizophrenia can be so debilitating and it needs to be intervened on quickly, whereas perhaps you have a little bit more time with bipolar disorder. So we can circle back a little bit, but since we introduced some of the symptoms, if there are any takeaways, the following acronym is useful, is very useful, and that is DIGFAST. So you might be asked, what are characteristic symptoms of bipolar disorder? So DIGFAST is the mnemonic that is common. So D for distractibility, I for indiscretion, risky activity. Dr. C's case, compulsive masturbation. Grandiosity, like you said, is G, or an inflated self-esteem. Flight of ideas, that is racing thoughts, tangential thoughts. A is for activity increased, and it tends to be goal-directed activity. So like Dr. I was alluding to, these grandiose, plans can be activity-oriented rather than totally irrational or disorganized, which might be more characteristic of schizophrenia. S is for sleep deficit. And I think that that's also, and doctors, you may agree with me, a useful symptom to distinguish from schizophrenia. So sleep deficit is important because these folks that are, feeling somewhat euphoric, have all these grand plans, will report going a week, sleeping 3-4 hours a night in some cases. That would be less characteristic, again, of something like schizophrenia. And then finally, talkative is T there. So pressured speech, an important clinical feature of the clinical presentation. So someone who's speaking very rapidly, they're talking about all their master plans. Oh, they're going to go home. They're going to put an extension on the house. They haven't slept in 4 days. Blah, 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 blah. Like that is bipolar, or be very, very suspicious about bipolar. Okay.
And just to elaborate on that a little bit, the sleep, it really is an important factor. It might be even a trigger for mania. Some of the preventative measures that we can talk about later include making sure that you don't pull all-nighters, even if you feel like, oh yeah, I can do this. Going a couple nights in a row kind of might put you in that state, that high-energy state. It can be especially tempting with that goal-directed activity. Coupled with that grandiosity, they feel like they have these special powers, maybe religious preoccupation, and they go into these projects, like writing projects. Ask them what they're writing about, and ideally ask them to show you what they've been writing, because if they say that they're writing a proof to prove the existence of God through AI or whatever, then get them to show you that work. And oftentimes you'll see that it's just a bunch of nonsense writing. Like, they feel like they've achieved a lot of goals, but they don't, because they're too disorganized, even especially at the more, at the more extreme impact on function. It is difficult to concentrate with that flight of ideas, and the talkativeness certainly demonstrates how it is that they're thinking. So with that flight of ideas, you might also notice some loosening of the associations, where the thoughts don't really link up to each other, but it can be an indication, a vocalization of what's happening inside.
Right. So yeah, they're like you point out, dig a little bit deeper when they're talking about being so productive, and how, let's analyze that work being produced, and get a sense of how disorganized it might be. Dr. C, anything to add there?
No, I'm wondering, are there any substance use disorders that can lead to kind of similar presentations?
Yeah, certainly. One thing you really want to watch out for is substance-induced psychosis, which can look quite a bit like mania. But the difference is that usually once the substances are cleared from the body, that they return to their normal mind state. And to assess for that, one of the things you can do is a urine tox screen, and inquire about the history of their drug use. And of course, you can get collateral. But usually the symptoms resolve on their own. But you can also have, you know, things like stimulants and other medications like SSRIs, you know, they can induce a manic episode as well. So getting a thorough history is really key in determining what the diagnosis is and, you know, consequently what the appropriate treatment is.
Right.
Right. So we spoke about DIGFAST as the acronym that's useful to define symptoms of a manic episode. And then further to that, I spoke about prior. This has to be a distinct period, okay? The majority of a week or seven consecutive days. And on those days, there has to be at least 4 of those symptoms that are included in DIGFAST. So with that, you'll be able to define a manic episode, and if there are one or more of those, this person may have and there's consequential functional impairment. This person may fit diagnostic criteria for bipolar 1. Good. So at this stage, I think it'll be useful to distinguish some of the other subtypes. So far we've focused on bipolar 1. Why don't you guys tell us a little bit about, and Dr. C, you spoke about bipolar 2, I believe, defined by hypomania. So what is hypomania? Is there sort of a functional definition to distinguish it from a manic episode?
I believe that in hypomania it might not be as clear to, I'm not sure about this, but I think it might be more clear to immediate family that they that their behavior has changed, but reduced mania. So yeah, just not as severe.
Yeah. And I think that that's a good functional definition. So not severe enough to affect social or occupational function.
Right.
By definition, but like you point out, loved ones will likely notice those behavioral changes or the patient themselves. But yeah, indeed, not severe enough to affect social or occupational function, and by definition does not require hospitalization, and there's no psychotic features,
right?
Per se, so no hallucinations, no fixed delusions, etc.
MCQ, just remember that it's still 3 of the DIGFAST criteria, but yeah, you really want to focus on the temporality. So the hypomanic episode is at least 4 days rather than 7. They might try to trip you up on that. As Dr. T said, the impairment and psychosis boost you to the manic category rather than hypomanic. And hospitalization diagnostically per the DSM also qualifies you for mania. That's I think it's one of the few diagnoses that are more so based on the physician's actions rather than like symptomatology.
Right. Cool. Okay. And Dr. C, from the top, you know, you spoke about bipolar 2 perhaps being more prevalent than we appreciate. And undoubtedly there are a lot of, you know, creatives such as yourself who suffer from this illness. It can facilitate in some cases creativity and certainly you know, a quick Google of you know, men of science and creatives will uncover lots of people who have suffered from bipolar 2 impulsive masturbation. So moving on to cyclothymic disorder, Dr. I, do you have a definition for cyclothymia?
Just keep in mind, like the cyclothymia, it's more of a rarer diagnosis. I think
right.
This is mostly for a testing purposes. but it basically involves multiple periods of symptoms of depression and periods of symptoms of hypomania, but neither cumulatively are sufficient for a diagnosis of MDE, like a major depressive episode or a hypomanic episode. So it's, I guess you can think of it more in terms of a lessened fluctuation in mood.
And I think I neglected to highlight that bipolar 2, by definition, will have depressive episodes, at least one depressive episode. Whereas bipolar 1, which is sort of odd in my interpretation, does not require a depressive episode. Okay.
Yeah. One so, yeah, and episode can diagnostically put you at bipolar 1.
Yeah, exactly. So what I guess, if you're in a hypomanic state and there's no functional consequences, well, then one might argue that it's not mental illness. So it should be associated with at least one depressive episode to fit that diagnostic criteria. Okay. So other, bipolar illnesses not otherwise specified. Let's just run this quickly. Major depressive episode and insufficient criteria for hypomania. Lots of people are going to fit that. Recurrent hypomania without depression. So that's what we spoke about. I think there's other names for that. But again, is that mental illness? Well, if there's no social or functional consequences, perhaps not. Mixed or manic episodes that are superimposed on a psychotic disorder like schizophrenia. Okay, probably not uncommon. And then unable to distinguish from perhaps an underlying substance or medical condition, so organic illness or substance misuse. And then finally, you've heard of rapid cycling. And I've heard the reason I bring up rapid cycling is because I think there's a lot of, and this is another distinction, BPDers or bipolar disorder folks who are actually borderline. They have borderline personality disorder. And I would always be suspicious when you see someone who's a rapid cycling bipolar. I definitely would think about borderline personality disorder. And unfortunately, the acronyms are the same. Okay, so not to confuse BPD with BPD.
All right. How about we talk about the assessment of a manic patient in, an emergency department, psychiatry emergency department type of setting?
Yeah. So Dr. C comes in. He was found, by his mom dehydrated after a 24-hour gooning session. He hasn't slept in days, and you come into his locked room. His eyes are bloodshot. He's disheveled. How might you start that interview?
Well, you have to be quite careful. Generally manic patients can be intimidating given the general nature of the potentially psychotic presentation. And oftentimes they might not be clear enough to give clear answers, and they might even be unsafe. So do your due diligence, make sure you're not putting yourself in a dangerous situation. Oftentimes I find that patients come in with this delusion of being a UFC fighter. It's so surprisingly common, but you have to be like careful, because they'll show off their moves, potentially.
Their moves.
Yeah. Even if you don't get a thorough history that coincides with what you would ask for the DSM criteria, the mental status exam will give you a lot of information. So for either of you fellas, what do you think the manic patient would look like? How would they behave? What would you kind of objectively see on their presentation?
What do you think, Dr. C?
kind of eyes moving around a lot, nonstop talking. very jittery, moving around a lot. That's all I can think of.
I use a mnemonic, and there's going to be a lot of mnemonics thrown around for mental status exam. ABC septic. So general appearance, we spoke about Dr. C, you know, being covered in his own excretions.
That's why he's dehydrated.
Disheveled. Yeah, he's dehydrated. He's dry. Disheveled. Behavior, like you described, erratic, perhaps pacing, some psychomotor agitation. C is for cooperative, so they may be non-cooperative. And documenting that is helpful for your other, you know, your clinical colleagues and concerns around agitation or violence. Speech, we spoke about pressured speech, so someone speaking very rapidly, perhaps tangential. In terms of emotions, affect is often irritable, or in the hospital setting, probably irritable or elevated. Mood could be great. And I have actually seen manic patients say, "Oh yeah, I'm doing fucking awesome, dude. You know, like, how are you doing? I'm doing amazing. I'm over the moon." But that / irritable. In terms of thought content, we spoke about grandiosity and big plans as being prominent. They may or may not have insight into their illness. You know, it's less psychotic than is schizophrenia. So some people know that they're bipolar and that they're having an episode and they need a little bit of help. And then cognitively, because there's some disorganized thinking, there may be deficits there as well. So I think those are some features on a mental status exam that might be important. And then although it's not necessarily part of the mental status exam per se, documenting or consideration around formability and suicidality, and, you know, at some point it's jurisdiction specific, but we could get into that. Documenting that as well would be important.
Yeah, I would just look up the Mental Health Act in your area. Some other things that would be useful to just to reemphasize again for any testing purposes. Asking about sleep history will always get you points, as we discussed earlier. Decreased need for sleep, specifically the need. You know, a depressed patient can have difficulty sleeping, but they still feel tired at the end of the day. These guys, you know, they've just been punching the air for hours and hours for days rather than sleeping, and they feel totally fine. Medication review and substance use history, as discussed earlier. You know, you especially want to check for an antidepressant because the manic episode may have been preceded by a depressive episode, which, you know, depending on the antidepressant, it can provoke a manic episode. So something to consider as well. You know, that point on, you know, oh, I feel great. You know, why am I even here? I don't want to get treated for this. I have work to do. I'm busy decoding, you know, the God complex. It's important to emphasize that this is a pathological process, and, similar to psychotic episodes, the more often these episodes happen, and the longer they persist, the easier it is to slip back into these episodes. You know, I don't know the exact pathophysiology around that, whether it's linked to kind of family history and an organic disorder or what have you. But, you know, you do want to be treating this patient. Most likely you will not be discharging this patient, and you'll want to try to get them to go to sleep. One.
Get some rest.
Yeah.
Okay. So and good. So we've assessed our patient with our mental status exam. We assessed formability, whether or not they're going to be treated as inpatient. And most folks that are having acute manic episode requiring hospital presentation will be formable. So let's then talk about maybe some baseline investigations. We spoke about our differential and the importance of urine tox, and I think that's hugely important because especially with cannabis and younger people, unfortunately, it's a very, very common trigger of of manic like symptomology, and then other stimulant, well, not the cannabis is particularly a stimulant, but stimulant substances like methamphetamine will be another common mimetic of bipolar illness.
I don't know, man.
What other
weed calms you down?
It actually weed makes you chill, man. Yeah, like it depends if it's an indica or a sativa. Like I would never prescribe a sativa for a manic patient, but as an adjunct, a little bit of an indica, like an Indicouch or one of those chiller strains could be useful potentially.
But you think that alternating between sativa and indica might be an effective treatment for bipolar?
To stabilize
the depressive episodes.
Exactly, you prescribe sativa during the depressive episodes and during the highs and indica to really bring things back down to the...
Well, we want to avoid polypharmacy as well, so maybe consider prescribing a hybrid strain as well.
A hybrid strain, yeah. And I think you can monitor serum indica levels. And in that way, really like titrate your strain to that therapeutic level. Consulting with a naturopath, with your naturopathic colleagues can be helpful in this setting. Anyway, that was a little bit of a digression. So moving on to some other investigations, we spoke about the piss test. Are we going to do any blood work?
General CBC. CBC lights, I guess more so depending on the patient age. You want to be a little more vigilant with the testing in a geriatric population. Things like you want to rule out things like infections or any sort of neurological processes, any sort of malignancy. But ultimately, some other simple tests you can do, TSH, kidney function.
Yeah, lights, extended lights, any sort of organ failure. So obviously, like hepatic encephalopathy can do it. So check the liver out, check your kidney. You spoke about kidney function. In terms of medication considerations, screening lipid levels and considering an ECG as well. As we know, a lot of the antipsychotics can cause dyslipidemia. And then some of the medications that we use, antipsychotics and antidepressants, are also QT prolongating. So getting that baseline ECG, especially in anyone that would have risk factors, would be important. You spoke about ruling out infectious etiologies. In an older person, that usually means routinely a chest x-ray and a urine dip for any infectious signs. And then remember, menstruating women, or I should say menstruating, I don't know what the language is there, but anyhow, menstruating
folks with a uterus. I think that's what
folks with the uterus.
Yeah,
are pregnant until proven out otherwise. So ensure that you get that that urine preg. Again, implications in terms of medications like teratogenic, valproic acid, and others. Okay, so I think that's useful. Oh, and then maybe at that stage, I would point out if they're known to have bipolar disorder and they're on any mood stabilizers, valproate or lithium, whatever it may be, you can assess whether or not they're therapeutic, whether or not they've been adhering to their medication. So those are going to be useful baseline investigations. Okay. So that's good. And thanks for pointing that out, Dr. I. Like especially someone who's elderly, who's having any sort of changes in level of consciousness, who has any focal neurologic symptoms, do consider the CT head. I think it's probably underutilized by psychiatry because like you said, intracranial mass, bleed can all cause changes in and mental status.
Oh, for sure. It's totally age-based, I find. Same with, I guess, in the emergency department, you're less likely to order a CT head for a 22-year-old. But, you know, full delirium workup in the elderly population, you have to keep your differential broad there.
Right. So, in this case, Dr. Seizman admitted we have him strapped down to the bed, which unfortunately he finds erotic. So it actually, it actually exacerbates his symptoms, and he's just repeatedly paging the nurse, requesting therapeutic masturbation. Mm. So still a sort of a risk, both to himself and other members of the care team. So certainly at this stage being brought in, how might we start? So we've confirmed that, you know, indeed he's having a manic episode. How might we start? And I should say that his investigations are all normal, other than, you know, perhaps a little bit of an AKI, a little bit of kidney injury related to dehydration. So we might bolus him to make him feel a little bit better if he's refusing to take fluids by mouth. But how are we going to treat this gentleman?
So I guess the plan, we're going to be admitting him, oftentimes based on the safety concerns. And even if the patient might say that they're feeling great, I think it's always a good idea to begin with offering oral medication based on the presentation. But, you know, you might need to get security in there and do some IM meds as well. In terms of medication choices, you know, I follow the CANMAT guidelines, which, you know, refer to the guidelines in whatever area you're in, but...
What's CANMAT? Is that for our Pakistani listeners?
Yeah, for our Eastern European listeners, Canadian Network for Mood and Anxiety Treatments. And the reason why I like this, you know, personally, I'm actually in Australia right now, mate. What I like about CANMAT is summaries. They have a hierarchical rankings of first and second line treatments for different presentations of bipolar disorder. So you can go ahead and Google those, and it's a nice, it provides a nice summary of what options you have available. So looking at the summary for severe agitation, which you are most likely to encounter in a more acute setting, so some of the first line agents include atypical antipsychotics. For the oral option, you have risperidone, Seroquel. You know, ideally the patient will take and then go to sleep and hopefully feel better. If they're too agitated to kind of tolerate a PO intake, we have IM antipsychotics, olanzapine, aprazidone, aripiprazole, and also Haldol with lorazepam. Can be is a common option. Benzos alone are usually given in a real world setting already, just based on the presentation. You know, in the emergency department, people want to chill out their patients a little bit, and oftentimes they'll have the benzos already. But at least the CANMED guidelines recommends antipsychotics first line rather than just benzos alone.
Yeah, and that is nice that you know, both quetiapine or Seroquel and risperidone are monotherapy options, and lots of, you know, people, GPs, will be very comfortable with those agents. Risperidone in particular is very safe, you know, metabolically not neutral, but usually well tolerated, safer in elderly folks as well. So I've seen people with bipolar maintained on risperidone. So that's fantastic that those first line agents are available to us. Then we, other monotherapy options are the mood stabilizers, like we spoke about, which I see commonly, that is lithium and valproic acid. And then some of these, you know, especially for folks where there's concerns around adherence, depot options, like aripiprazole or Abilify and paliperidone. So both of those agents are available as a depot, and that is a an IM injection, let's say every, you know, as frequently as every 2 weeks, but on the order of months even. So that's sort of the monotherapy option. But like you point out, in the acutely agitated patient, oftentimes they're going to end up with some Haldol and lorazepam. But during that admission, stabilizing them with one of these antipsychotics or mood stabilizers as a single agent is definitely an option.
Yeah, you can certainly start lithium right away. You know, pro tip for the exam. I mean, you can use lithium for just about anything related to bipolar disorder. It works. It's just that you have to really watch for the side effects, which we can get into later.
Cool. So that's a first glance at the medications. The combination medications usually are mood stabilizer, that is lithium or valproate, plus antipsychotic. That would be a normal combination approach. And then beyond that, that's probably beyond the scope of the current podcast. So why don't I, if it's okay with you, Dr. I and Dr. C, do you want to mention some considerations around lithium? So, you know, underlying thyroid or kidney dysfunction and maybe what sort of surveillance is required with that medication?
Hell yeah. I can get right into that, balls deep into the side effects of lithium. We've got sedation. We've got weight gain. We've got, you want to watch for rashes. Patients will often complain about polyuria, polydipsia. Another side effect to watch for is tremor, especially noted with outstretched hands. You know, those are some of the softer side effects, but given how regularly you need to take lithium, these are all factors for potential discontinuation. So if the patient doesn't like it, then that's something you're going to have to address. And then some of the more severe side effects, the main organs that you want to remember that the lithium impacts are the thyroid, the kidneys, and the heart. So you want to monitor these organs for effect. As we mentioned earlier, you know, for the heart, we want to get a baseline ECG and maybe follow up every 6 to 12 months on that. TSH in the beginning of the lithium treatment as well to get a baseline. And again, every 6 to 12 months, I'd say follow up on that. And again, for kidney function, we've got our creatinine levels, which every 6 months should be sufficient. But, you know, use your own discretion based on what comorbidities the patient has. And of course, make sure you monitor these organs with any dosage changes. And, another thing we should mention is the teratogenic effects of lithium. So the pregnancy test is key. And I've seen on some exams, they ask about what the effect is. Does anybody know? Pop quiz. We're getting pimped. We're getting pimped.
Yeah. Pimped.
Pimped.
I'm trying to think of the heart one, but that's with valproate, right?
The heart one's lithium.
Is it lithium? Oh shit!
Yeah. I made a mistake earlier there.
Oh my bad.
Fucking retard.
I don't recall what it is, what the name of it is.
It's Epstein's anomaly.
Yeah. So that's lithium. Oh shit.
Yeah.
Okay, Epstein.
Yeah.
Epstein. Good. Little St. James. Anonymous, yeah. Okay. Dr. C, any comments there? What's your preferred agent?
My preferred agent?
Yeah.
So, what were you going to say?
How would you like to be sedated?
I like clonazepam.
I like Xanny bars.
Okay. I like hydrocodone.
Okay. I don't know that hydrocodone has specific evidence in bipolar, but okay.
Yeah, I'm not seeing that on the CanMet guidelines.
Oh, the other feature with lithium is monitoring extended lights. So magnesium and calcium can become, the divalent cations can become dysregulated as well.
Yeah,
do that. So do that with your blood work.
And another thing too that I should mention is lithium toxicity. You know, the typical range for serum lithium that we're looking for is between, for acute treatment, I guess it would be 0.8 to 1.2. You know, that certainly is going to vary, but that's based on my reading. And then more for maintenance, you know, you want to stay at 0.6 to 1.0, but you know, even 1.0, generally I would say anything over 1.0 is going to be concerning, you know, especially in the geriatric population. It's going to be symptom based, so you should be concerned about the higher range of normal. You know, if somebody's having symptoms with 0.8, then you know, and they're better at 0.5 and their symptoms are well controlled on 0.5, then you know, stick at 0.5.
yeah, use lowest effective dose.
For serum lithium monitoring, just make sure that blood is drawn 12 hours after the last lithium dose.
Right. So it's trough dosing with all of these. Good. Okay. So I think that is a really good outline of BPD. I should say bipolar disorder, yeah. Not to be confused with borderline personality disorder. Any other sort of ancillary treatments? Obviously, medication is life-saving for a lot of these folks. So really one of the fantastic treatments that are available within psychiatry as a field. Any other sort of ancillary treatments that we might offer for these folks, or other therapies that might be useful?
Yeah, I mean, if you're scratching your head on the exam and you're like, oh, what non-pharmacological methods can I use? Psychoeducation, always a safe bet. You know, teach them about it and bring their family in. Make sure that everybody can recognize the prodromal symptoms, the toxicity symptoms, side effects, and kind of what to watch for to avoid a readmission, because recurrence is common even with medication. And you know, to stay off the stimulants, stay off the weed, stay off the alcohol. Steroid use, one thing to watch out for as well. Good to just warn them about it.
That is anabolic steroid, or like prednisone, that type of thing.
Like prednisone.
Probably both, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think, I think you do see there's increased dopamine levels with anabolic, but yeah, certainly, you know, let's say pulsing of prednisone, that can do it.
Yeah. And on the extreme, you can throw on CBT as well. Personally, I found that you know, you can just throw that answer in for just about anything. To be honest,
CBT, calm the fuck down.
I'm actually talking ball torture. Mixed results, but
Dr. C, did you find anything else helpful with your past episodes?
No, just cutting out the weed, cutting out the stimulants were two big ones for me. Right. But I think Dr. I already mentioned those. Yeah.
What about your compulsive masturbation?
Well, I found that to be one of the triggers that would lead to manic episodes. So I staying on NoFap is very, very useful, I think, for a lot of patients.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. You know, anecdotally, I've heard a lot about NoFap. So it would be interesting to study that with a little more rigor in the setting of bipolar illness. Very good. So I think in summary, we distinguished BP1, bipolar 1, from 2. We highlighted that DIGFAST mnemonic. And then we talked about an important differential, investigations that will be relevant to medications that are used, and these fantastic life-saving medications for folks that suffer from what is, you know, potentially a very treatable illness. So I hope that this was high yield, both for your board exams, your tests, as well as for future patients.